Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay. Every week we chat with an influencer to see what makes them tick. And today, Friday, June 11th, 2010, I'm delighted to welcome David, and I hope I say your name, last name correctly, Sock.
Is it that's correct, yeah.
Who is a founding partner of, David, why don't you tell us what your actual official title is?
So I'm just one of several general partners at Matrix Partners, not the founding partner, because the firm was founded about 30 years ago by Paul Ferry. But I guess what you were thinking about when you were thinking about founders is I was previously an entrepreneur and founded multiple companies before becoming a VC.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think this is a fascinating area. You're our first VC, and I would say that, you know, and you, one of the reasons that for the audience listening that it's so exciting to have David on is he's a very prolific blogger, and his blog is fantastic. It's called forentrepreneurs.com, F-O-R, and has a lot of very wise advice. So let's start there because, you know, that's sort of how I became aware of you via Facebook and Dave McClure, you know, mentioning this fabulous blog he couldn't believe he hadn't already found. How did the blog evolve?
So it was out of the fact that I'm constantly spending time with entrepreneurs, and it's one of my great pleasures in life is trying to help them. And I spent time on a series of subjects that I realized were quite important to the success of startups that weren't widely known. And every time I talked about these ideas to people, they were saying, wow, that's really interesting. So I then started to realize that there's probably a wider group of people that would be really interested in hearing about this as well. So one of the first topics that I kicked off with was this concept of the title of the blog post was Startup Killer, the Cost of Customer Acquisition. And this is really warning entrepreneurs about an issue that I've seen kill an awful lot of startup companies, where the entrepreneur's enthusiasm and excitement for their own product is such that they get very carried away with the thought that as soon as they build the product or as soon as they build the website, it's automatically going to get tons of traffic, and they're just going to automatically succeed because of that customer coming and finding them. And, of course, as we all know, the real world doesn't work like that. You put up a website, and there are thousands of other great websites out there, and you've got to do things to bring those customers in. And typically those things that you do to attract customers in the form of paid search or even, you know, SEO and other forms of work that you can do in the marketing area will cost you quite a lot of money. And what I think people always underestimated that I thought was worth writing about was that cost of acquiring your customers is often way higher than any entrepreneur realizes. And unless they figure out a way to charge a lot of money for what it is that they're selling, they may actually end up paying more money to acquire the customer than they will get back from the customer paying them during its lifetime. Mm-hmm. So that was a blog that seemed to be very well received, and it was one of those messages that I've been thinking about a lot during my life as an entrepreneur and realized might be something that would be worthwhile. So it was really gratifying, I must say, to put that out as a blog article and see such a great response from the readership out there. So that was my introduction to it.
When was it, and how? What kind of feedback did you receive initially?
There's two groups out there. The one group were people who really agreed with me and who'd actually had bad experiences where they'd made this mistake. And then there was the other group, which was people that really hadn't thought about this before, and this was a new idea and a new concept for them. And they were writing in and saying, wow, you know, this explains something that I've observed, but I haven't actually been able to put into words here, which is that we're spending this fortune on this direct sales force, and every time we get a sale, we're just, you know, we can't get profitable here because we're not charging enough money for what it is that we get at the end of the sale. So what I found was really interesting is that the people in the B2C space doing consumer internet sites, they're actually pretty familiar with this because they had websites where measuring the cost of customer acquisition was amazingly clear, particularly since Google came along, because this is the very first time that you could directly equate the price that you paid to Google for the number of people that clicked through to your site. And then most B2C sites were very used to the idea of having great metrics to measure the number of people that clicked through from being a visitor on their website to perhaps starting up a free trial and then finally maybe buying something. So B2C companies actually understood this really well. But it was, you know, most of my audience was actually B2B companies that had never used these same discipline metrics as an approach to figuring out whether what they were doing was actually working or not. And I think one of the, you know, really fascinating aspects of this is that if you want to run a business in today's world, one of the key success factors is being excellent at metrics and being excellent at experimentation and trying multiple different things very, very quickly and using metrics to determine what's the right thing to proceed with. And then as soon as you've got that one experiment figured out, you should use immediately another experiment to try to refine the thing even further.
And so how much, so there's, you know, this experimental phase, I think, you know, is very important, but I think it's probably more than a phase. I think, you know, I think you and I talked about the need for companies to be more agile than ever in terms of trying different things, both online and offline, to get the attention that they need in the right places to, you know, get additional funds or, you know, basically to make their business successful.
Yep.
You know, I think that one of the maybe misconceptions, or you tell me, I mean, I think, you know, I go through the list of, you know, companies that acquire funds, and I know what the ideas are from various conferences that I go to. And sometimes I'm just shocked that a concept gets the kind of funding that it does. And so there's this, you know, kind of discussion around overfunding, you know, at the moment, where you know, there's some companies are getting nothing, and then some that are just getting more than they're ever going to really need. And part of this is, you know, being able to, you know, project, you know, the cost of being able to experiment with metric systems and other, you know, things like Omniture that can be expensive and need to be implemented by smart people that can cost money, or do cost money, etc. So How do you approach that or look at the funding aspect of having the tools in place that do cost money for a company that's trying to build a presence and make it a profitable one?
Right,
or get
well,
profit.
Lots of little different angles in what you were asking there, but let me start with one here, which I think is really exciting for entrepreneurs, which is because of two things. Open source being one of them and the cloud being the other one, it's actually become incredibly inexpensive for entrepreneurs to start companies and do enough testing to figure out if their idea has that first level of traction. And I would say that it's not uncommon to, you know, to hear of some people getting this done for as little as $100,000 where they're really doing the development themselves. But I've often heard of companies, you know, that are doing this for in the $500,000 range to just get to that, get to marketplace and get some initial indications that they are, that there is product market fit. This is a term that you probably heard a lot. It's we use it an awful lot in the venture capital world. It's a determination of that stage where you've really figured out that there are customers out there that are very excited about what you've built. And I think that's a key stage for a company. Once you've hit that stage, then you want to figure out the next piece, which is, you know, how do you acquire customers and build a repeatable sales process. But so you don't actually need as much capital as you used to. The old days, it was common that you needed $5 million, and as a result of that, there was far fewer funding sources that you could go and get that $5 million from, so there were fewer startups. I think right now what we've got is an explosion in the number of startups, and they're being funded by angels who can easily provide this $500,000 or even $100,000 level of funding for them. And then once they hit a certain stage of traction, they then want to seek growth funding from other sources. So the venture capital world, I think, likes to play in that early stage as well. They just don't do it in quite the same way that the angels do. So a typical angel may invest in as many as 20 different startups, but they won't get very involved with them, whereas a typical VC is only going to invest in a small number of things, because the one key thing we've learned is that we can really dramatically affect the outcome at the companies that we get involved with by working with them. And we can't work with them if we do too many of them. So we're more selective about which ones we'll pick, but it doesn't matter what stage they are. We will pick seed investments. We'll pick early stage investments. And we'll pick some of the slightly more later stage things where they've gotten traction as well to invest in. But the key difference is this notion of how much time you spend and invest with the startup to really help provide them with the guidance and things like team building and recruiting that can be so helpful.
Mm-hmm. The kind of things that they probably couldn't afford to pay you for.
Yes, exactly. And we provide all of that for free, which is a really interesting value add. It's and you know, when you think about that, I tell you one of the areas where we can really be helpful is if you're trying to hire somebody as a startup and you're a no-name small company with a tiny amount of funding in, and you want to hire a senior executive out of a Google or an eBay or somewhere like that, and that executive is being paid a lot of money and has a great title and has a family to worry about, the difference between them being phoned up by this entrepreneur that has a small amount of funding versus getting a call from a really reputable VC firm that's got a phenomenal track record of successfully investing and creating successful outcomes for people working in its companies, that VC has tremendous credibility in being able to attract that person and give them the confidence to leave their job and feel the security that their family is not going to be endangered if they make that big jump.
Mm-hmm. Which I think is a really interesting dynamic. One of the things is on the other side is, you know, kind of what VCs look to invest in and kind of the give and take of the relationship, of course, of companies that would be pitching you or looking to pitch you versus companies that you would almost go and pitch yourself or would be eyeing, I guess.
Yes.
How does that dynamic work for VCs?
It's really interesting. You know, I think there's as much selling on both sides of that fence. Particularly if there's a hot deal, the VC will be selling like crazy to get in because there's a lot of competition for the hot deals. So you spend a lot of time making sure the ideal thing, really, to be candid, is to get to know the entrepreneur before the deal becomes hot and before they've actually started the company. And that's what we really try to do is we focus on building a network of people and we focus on trying to help them well before they even become entrepreneurs. And as soon as they start to think about becoming entrepreneurs, we also focus on trying to help them at that stage. And if we do that well, then by then we've earned the relationship and the trust and it's not that competitive a deal, and that's the perfect scenario. But that scenario doesn't always happen, and you may find a situation where you haven't heard of the entrepreneur. They may even be somebody that's just a student that really isn't at all well-known and nobody would have known of them, and they've got to come up with a great startup like Mark Zuckerberg would have done. And then if you're faced with a deal like that, it's a competitive deal, and it's really important for the VC to pitch them well and become known as a person who can help them. And I think the key thing that they're looking for there is, you know, what degree of help, what degree of experience, what degree of network value add, what degree of strategic partnerships can this person bring to my company if I brought them on board as a board member and investor. And that's an area where we have to work pretty hard to ensure that the entrepreneurs really understand that we're differentiated and that there really is a big difference between good VCs and bad VCs, as oftentimes they're so wowed by this aura of VCs that they're not actually looking hard to do the buying, so they're just kind of doing a very surface level evaluation. In reality, this is one of the most important decisions they can make in their lives. I often say to entrepreneurs, look, this is picking a VC is worse than getting married, because at least with the marriage you can get divorced. But you know, if you once you've picked a VC and they're in your company, there's a one-way divorce that can happen, which is they can fire you sometimes, not always, but you can't ever get rid of them. So you're really stuck with them. And I think my recommendation to entrepreneurs there is that they should really do the work of phoning the companies that have worked with that VC and get to know the personality and find out how they behave under bad circumstances when the company, things aren't going well at the company. That's a very important indicator of what kind of a person you're dealing with. You can easily get the person who just panics. And, just fully understand what the value add is that they bring. And again, my key comment here would be that there's a huge spectrum from good to bad, and don't lump everybody together. Do your work to figure out who falls into the good and great category, and work with those people, even if it means a slightly lower valuation, which generally isn't the case. But you know, if that was the case, I'd still recommend, because the one thing I can tell you that my own experience was that when you look back at the end of the day, when your company's been successful, the last thing anybody worries about was what valuation you got in your Series A or your Series B. What you do look back and comment on, though, is, my God, we were lucky to have that person on the board because they were so supportive at that critical moment, or they provided that critical insight that we needed, or they provided that critical introduction and helped to win that strategic partner. And those things are game-changing versus the you know, common thing that we occasionally see from naive entrepreneurs, which is where they'll focus on valuation, which really is the wrong thing to pay attention to.
And that was just what I was going to ask you about, was how does valuation fit in? Because, if you know, especially when you have an entrepreneur where maybe you've created a friendly relationship, so there's obviously many different scenarios. But it seems like valuation lately, especially I think probably with the emergence of some television programs as well, is where, you know, a lot of focus, rightly or wrongly, lies. You know, how much in the real world do people really approach you with valuations where you just go, this is just not workable, this is craziness.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, literally. I mean, that's the only other thing I can think of to call it. But, you know, it's an insane valuation, and yet you like it, you know, and you try to come to some middle ground. Do you, if the valuation is crazy, do you even try to come to middle ground even if you like it, or how do you negotiate that?
Yeah, it's a really great question, and it's just such a sad question for me because I've honestly just been through an experience like this recently, and the answer is yes, there are some very crazy valuations out there, and perhaps I can explain why I think those crazy valuations are happening, which is investors have sort of figured out there's one or two kinds of companies that they really all want to get into. So if they see one of those types of companies that's got traction, that's got good-looking metrics, that's headed in a good direction, every VC wants to get into that deal. And the problem is there's just a shortage of supply of those kinds of companies, and the net result is that the prices get pushed up, and it's a supply problem that's causing the prices to get pushed up. But the real issue is that when you look at the pricing compared to the public markets, which is the exit opportunity, or public buyers who are likely to buy those companies and the prices that they're paying to acquire companies at, these investment rounds are occurring at three times higher or sometimes even five times higher than the multiples that you're seeing in the public markets for companies that have the same comparable growth. But the public companies are clear market leaders, whereas these private companies are not clear market leaders and still have lots of risk associated with their execution. So the prices are crazy, and I think the disciplined investor will walk from those, and we do that, but you know, we won't do it without trying to talk to the entrepreneur and explain to them really that the notion of going and getting too high of a valuation can potentially bite them. First of all, you know, the one key thing that I was talking about earlier on is the value that you can get from a great investment partner. And I know this is a pretty rare phenomenon that you get a great investor. So that's part of the issue here, is that there's a lot of weaker investors out there. So it's not always that you're going to get the great investor. But if you do get the great investor, the value add can be absolutely game-changing. And, you know, there's lots and lots of stories of where you've seen that game-changing type of input happen. But in the situation where the entrepreneur takes too high of a valuation and then doesn't perform, what they've done is created unrealistic expectations for the company, and they've put themselves in jeopardy because, you know, everybody who's unhappy after that is in a mode where they're going to be looking around for who to blame when this thing doesn't produce the spectacular returns that they were expecting to get out of it. So that's another thing to be aware of if you do take a high valuation, is you set yourself up for potential failure. I always try to convince people that the best way to look at this is not a game that you want to be trying to win. this is really about a partnership. You want to build a great partnership with your investors. And when you want to build great partnerships, the best thing you can do is look for win-win relationships. And to do a win-win, you know, there needs to be a little bit of give on both sides to meet in the middle. And sometimes you can achieve that, and occasionally you'll meet an entrepreneur who's fixated on valuation, and you will, you know, just need to walk from the deal when that happens.
Yeah, that's, you know, there's a database that I look through. I don't know if I should name it, but, you know, that does list, you know, how much companies are getting. And I remember there was a specific travel site recently I saw got so much money, I thought, how in the world are they ever going to exit or basically make back that money, even if they did an IPO and, you know, became a public company on their own, if they were able to build a brand that large.
Very good observation.
And then you look at burn rates and, you know, what they're spending their money on. So that's another, I think, interesting question is the power of the pitch and what the entrepreneur, you know, how defined do you like the entrepreneur to be in terms of where they want to spend the funds? And are there areas that you wouldn't want them to? For example, paying themselves a salary because they're getting, you know, they're getting an investment in a company and they're essentially providing sweat equity. I mean, how do you evaluate that?
Yeah. So actually, that one's really one of the easier places for discussion. I don't think we ever really have major disagreements with good entrepreneurs about where they should spend the funds. You know, the really good entrepreneurs are automatically cash conscious and don't want to pay themselves a fortune. If they do, there's a bit of a red flag for you right there. That's not an entrepreneurial trait to want to use the money to pay yourself. Most of them realize that the key to using that cash is that they should use it to grow the business. And you know, most entrepreneurs are very focused on that as their top priority. And if they can spend a dollar on marketing versus paying themselves some huge salary, they realize that putting the money into the marketing will end them up with a much more valuable long-term stock price, which is really where they can make true money as an entrepreneur, not out of salaries. So we generally have very little disagreement about that. I've never run into that as an issue.
Go ahead.
You asked the first question, which is how defined do we like people to be about the pitch? And did you want me to expand on that a little bit in terms of,
I think that's a very interesting area.
Yeah. So actually, you know, some of our best deals have had the most undefined pitches, and it'll be literally nothing more than it'll start with just a lunch with an entrepreneur and vaguely discussing an idea that then turns into a couple more meetings, and they then start to define it. And, you know, whether it's on a PowerPoint slide deck or just in a verbal pitch to you, doesn't matter. I think what we're looking for as key criteria, one of the most important things is the entrepreneur themselves. Do we get excited about this person? And there's a lot of bad-mouthing of VCs in this area, because I have to say that, you know, you see people saying, well, VCs will only invest in people over 35 or people who've previously been successful, and that's just not true. You know, we really love to invest in first-time entrepreneurs. When we spot the kind of traits and personality and energy and charisma and the kind of product-oriented drive and market understanding. So that would be top on the list of things that we'd be looking for, is who's the entrepreneur and how much do we get excited by them. And next we would go to, you know, how good is the market space that they're addressing. And I personally, since I have been more focused on B2B investing in the past, we'll always be looking at the question of, you know, what's the customer pain that this is solving? How severe is that pain? Because if it's not severe enough, there are many cool products that I've seen being built that just didn't gain traction because there really wasn't enough of a motivation on the customer side to disrupt and actually spend money and implement something. And there's a few other things that are really important to me to look at as well in that list, but you know, market size, product vision, barriers to entry, and the skill of the entrepreneur would really be very key elements for making a decision.
So in terms of your investments, it sounds like, and from what I've read, you invest in technology. And, you know, there's always that, you know, worry, you know, especially with these we're talking about, you know, kind of the persona of the almost perfect entrepreneur. How do you deal with sort of knowledge transfer as you invest in a company to make sure that you've secured the investment in the sense of knowledge transfer in the event that that person, you know, sorry for the unfortunate phrase, but gets hit by a bus?
Right, right. You know, the truth is that we're very deeply dependent on the original entrepreneur. It's one of the core things that we just have to live with. And there is a certain amount of knowledge transfer that can happen, but you can never transfer the personality of that entrepreneur. When you look at Steve Jobs, you know, other people can try to emulate him, but he's that guy. Bill Gates, Larry Ellison, you know, the multiple names that you can think of that are that driving force, that visionary. And unfortunately, when we do these investments, we do put key man insurance in place, but it's tiny. You know, we might have $1 million policy on the key man. That's never going to replace the fact that if we lost Bill Gates in Microsoft, you know, you just wouldn't find a replacement for the guy. So I don't think there really is a good way to transfer the key skills of that person. So we're deeply keen on ensuring that our entrepreneurs survive and don't get hit by a bus.
Get a bodyguard on them, I guess.
We never do anything like that, but it's, you know, we just know that they're the jewel in the company. They are so crucial to the success of the business that we never want to mess with that formula.
That's a great way to answer the question. I think, you know, obviously, you know, dedication is part of that. They have to be as dedicated with you as you've discussed this in terms of points where you may have to, you know, you have a disagreement, but you need to come to some middle ground. You have to. It's almost like a marriage where you have to say, you know, am I willing to compromise or is this a deal breaker?
Yeah. Yeah, and in fact, I think one of the important things that a VC and entrepreneur both need to do during the courtship phase before the investment happens is they really need to spend enough time with each other to find out whether they can handle a disagreement and find out whether they're compatible and, do that reference checking as well to find out how that person behaves and under different circumstances. Because you are going to go through some potentially stressful times if things don't go well. And you really want to be very clear that you've got yourself somebody that's got the same mindset and that you can work through difficult periods and get to compromises on tough decisions.
I think I've told you that I'm a big fan of Dragon's Den, especially the UK. We started watching the Canadian version as well. But I always remember the woman that came in and she had this idea for olives served at pubs and you know, it was actually a pretty good concept, but her supplier, I guess, was in Spain, and she asked if anyone in the room was Spanish, knowing that the program is televised, and then basically maligned the entire nation by saying they're liars, and they put things on the product that aren't on the label, and on and on and on. And one of the investors, I think, said the most crucial thing, which is, if you're going to behave like that with us in this room, not counting the camera, who knows what else you'd say. So I think there has to be this implicit level of trust that they're not going to go and do something insane like that. That is, even if she didn't mean it, it came off so badly that it's you know, something that anybody who's watched that episode of the program will always remember.
Yeah, huge damage. I actually never saw that, unfortunately, but it's a perfect example of what I was saying about how important it is to figure out who you're working with on both sides of the fence. You know, just as much of the importance for the entrepreneur to figure out whether they like the investor and the investor's not going to do anything bad to them once they're in the company.
Yes, the alignment with, can you imagine the alignment with any of the people in that room, their companies or investment firms with her would have just been, it was just impossible at that point. But
yeah.
I wanted to
move
a little bit to a topic that came up at Le Web 2009 in Paris last December, where Paul Carr from TechCrunch had a panel of European entrepreneurs, and some I wouldn't even call entrepreneurs because they run such large businesses. Martin Varsovsky, example, from Phone, who's now based in Spain after, you know, he's had many success or a couple of big successes here in the U.S. and elsewhere. And he basically, Paul Carr wanted the answer to the question, and this is the only thing he basically asked the panel over the course of a half an hour to the point where I felt like it was almost demeaning, but why not just, and he used an expletive, get on a plane, I'll say, and go to California and get money. And I think one of the intriguing things here is, one, that you yourself are a pretty international person,
yep.
And that you're also in Boston. And, you know, basically these all of the entrepreneurs on the panel had dealt with Silicon Valley, and they hadn't talked about any other parts of the United States being places where they would potentially get VC funds or any other kind of funding. So Freddie Minnie was on the panel from NetVibes, who spends half his time here, half his time in France. And I'm just curious what your thoughts are on the European investment market, and, you know, do you do any overseas investing, or the barriers to having a cohesive market, because they're also different, just
yeah.
too great to bear?
Yeah. Now, I think there's a huge differential, but I have to be honest here and say that I have not been raising funds, and I haven't been over there talking to entrepreneurs. So I'm going to tell you about some data that is a little bit anecdotal and secondhand that I've had passed on to me from
mm-hmm.
UK entrepreneurs who've tried raising capital. And we just funded a UK firm recently called Huddle that actually I think they'd had good experiences with their investors. But the general message that comes back is that there are some good investors in Europe, but the number is tiny by comparison with the U.S. And also the criteria that they're looking for in terms of what they'll invest in is far, far stricter. So they're much less able to look at an entrepreneur and a concept and judge that as being valuable, whereas and I think one of the reasons for that, by the way, is pretty simple, which is that the makeup of the people who are working in those venture capital firms, not all of them, and I want to be careful here because you can make a generalization and this is dangerous, but a lot of the guys working in the venture capital industry in Europe have not been entrepreneurs themselves and have not been as close to the entrepreneurial world as the U.S. VCs and many of the U.S. VCs like myself who have actually been entrepreneurs themselves. Really have a different view of the ability to read a concept and back a concept. And I think that's the complaint that you hear so much is that they aren't able to take early stage ideas and aren't willing to back those. But again, I do want to sort of apologize to anybody in Europe that gets offended by this because this is not a generalization. I do know there are some great people over there that are doing some good work, and oftentimes they're angels that are helping to get these concept companies off the ground.
Absolutely, and I, you know, the LeWeb conference, I should say, for those that don't know, has a piece of it that is about investment. They have an investment competition that's there, and it's very encouraged for, I mean, I talked with a number of business people when I was there who were, you know, looking for investment opportunity or talking with people, you know, and that is part of the purpose of the conference. So obviously that's a large commitment on the part of the conference organizers, the LEC,
yeah.
and his
wife.
Did
you see any great companies there?
You know, there was one, Jolie Cloud, that I thought was fascinating. It's about basically making your entire desktop experience a part of the cloud.
Right.
Which I think eventually everything will have to be. And this is from an entrepreneur who's had quite a few successes. He's probably one of the most famous people in the investors or entrepreneurs goes in France, but not necessarily is known here. So, you know, like Freddie Minnie is probably much more famous in France and in the EU in general than in the United States. It's sort of the same with this gentleman who was one of the people that started NetVibes himself before, and I think with Freddie in the early stages. But I think that was a very fascinating piece. And although I do think it's in a way inevitable, it's very replicatable. It's very much something that, you know, I'm not sure how much IP you can really put around it. And
yeah.
But I thought it was just, you know, he was just thinking kind of in the moment just seems so right to grab that company. And I think so far I've been following it and it's been doing fairly well.
That's great to hear. You know, we have one interesting company in our portfolio called Gilt.com. I don't know whether you're a customer of Gilt. Do you like them?
I'm not a customer of Gilt. No, I am not.
Okay. So the reason why I brought them up is that they actually are modeled after a French company called Vente Privée. And Vente Privée is a very successful business. And the guys at Gilt recognized that and realized that there was tremendous potential to bring that same model into the U.S. So the innovation actually happened in France in that particular case. And we're an interesting firm because we have offices in Shanghai and Beijing and Mumbai, as well as New York and Boston and Palo Alto. And the thing that was fascinating, it was last week we all got together with the various different players from India and China on the California coast. And one of the conversations that we had that was really fascinating was discussing the different things that were happening in America that could be transferred to China and vice versa. And I think there are some really fascinating opportunities for idea arbitrage. And one of the sort of proofs of that is that two of our founding partners in both China and India, both of them started the equivalent of eBay in those two countries and did very successfully and then sold to eBay and then joined Matrix as venture partners.
Well, I think the interesting thing about Gilt is, and you're talking G-I-L-T.
Yes.
And it's, you know, very fashion-based, but you know, it sells things, sells, you know, designer goods and services, and does a little bit more than that. They also have information about, you know, yoga studios and things like that. Very interesting. I'm on their mailing list. I haven't actually purchased anything quite yet because I, you know, just for whatever reason, I haven't, but, you know, completely amenable to it. But,
right.
You know, I think it's interesting because of the themes here and also the layout. It's very visual. And having worked with, you know, BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, knowing kind of the differences in UI and what appeals, I, you know, immediately would go, gosh, you know, Brazil would go nuts for this site, but China would need to see the characters. That
yeah.
was what our
yeah.
UI testing told us, that, you know, we would have posters of these really well-known, you know, films that we had streaming online, and they wouldn't click on the poster. But if you didn't have the poster in Brazil, there's just no way that they would click on text. So, I mean, just basic things, you know, usability is really
yeah.
interesting. But I wonder how much of that you have sort of collected or if there's someone there on staff that kind of or people that you go to provide you with that kind of knowledge and insight. You had talked about a roundtable that you put together. I don't know how public you do or don't want to make that, but it, just in terms of collecting, you know, data points and information about various
yeah, particular markets
issues.
And areas, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, you know, last night was a great event that we had. We had 17 SaaS CEOs that sat together for 3.5 hours and then had dinner together afterwards. And what we did with that event was we specifically focused it in on customer acquisition, which is really changing in a huge way for these low-cost SaaS companies. It's much more of a web-oriented online marketing type of a phenomenon, maybe with some inside sales assistance. So we had companies like HubSpot and Constant Contact and FreshBooks and Squarespace and other players like that at this event. And just phenomenal event because the people were so incredibly creative. And we got great feedback afterwards from the attendees that they got huge value out of it because every one of them, there's so much experimentation going on in this area that very few people know what the best practices are and, you know, what's the return if you try TV advertising versus radio advertising versus paid search versus, you know, using inbound marketing versus Facebook advertising versus social media. So great, great group, lots of fabulous discussion. And I think everybody was telling me that they learned so much from it that it was something they really want to repeat on a regular basis there. So that was one event that I did. And the other one that I mentioned to you previously was this social media gathering where I pulled together a bunch of people, mainly people who had the title of social media expert inside of a company. And then I also brought in a person from an agency, somebody from Forrester, and a couple of vendors into the thing. And the goal of that was to try to figure out, you know, what's the next phase of social media? Because this is so disruptive to organizations. It's such an important new communication medium that we were interested in trying to figure out, you know, when you go beyond the simple engagement that we're seeing today and the simple tools that are available today that do primarily monitoring, you know, what's going to happen with the next area? Are we going to see tools that are really directly focused at the sales process and how you can find new customers using tools like Twitter and Facebook? And will you see tools that are built specially for doing market research using social media? Will you see tools that are built for the HR person to explicitly leverage you know, social media for recruiting purposes? What will you see coming out for people who are in the support role that will help them leverage social media to perform their job well and find unhappy customers and intercept them and really quickly turn them around? And what do you need in the way of, this is one of the sort of tricky problems with social media, is that it is sort of an individual thing. I think companies do best when their individual employees actually are allowed to express their own voice, but that's also a very non-corporate thing. You know, what happens if you have some very key message that you want to have everybody stay linked to, and what happens if two or three people are all talking to one important influencer and they're accidentally crossing their wires and annoying this person because too many people from the same company are hitting them with the same different messages all at the same time.
Absolutely.
So do we need some kind of a corporate level coordination to ensure that that kind of mistake doesn't happen? And how does that coordination not damage the instantaneous and authentic feel of really good social media interactions that come from the best, you know, the best kinds of companies where there's a very authentic individual on the web tweeting and being able to express themselves without that feeling that the corporation has gone through a long workflow to approve this message before they put out that 140 characters.
Yeah, I'm a huge believer in having a social media, not just social media, but I really like Cisco's internet postings policy, which they call an open source policy, and say, you know, to companies, you know, you can take it and adopt it as your counsel suggests. And it's, you know, it's a good place to start to take a look at, but, you know, using it as a guideline and start talking to companies about, okay, if you're going to have some sort of guidelines, if somebody really breaches them, where does enforcement fall? Because you tend to be, if you're outside the company or even inside companies, this is where you really see siloing being a problem because, you know, social media / digital really crosses the marketing MarCom boundary.
Yeah.
And obviously goes into, you know, budget areas of web and other areas where, you know, there's just different funding sources for. So it's a little hard, I think, for some companies to figure out additional funding strategies for. And I think it's interesting that you bring that up because, you know, obviously, especially in the U.S., you know, there's free speech, but at the same time, you know, for the good, you know, the good employees that want to help evangelize the message, what are you going to do? You need to have something in place to tell them what is okay and what isn't okay, I think.
Yeah.
At least to start. I'm curious in your social media gathering if you had Augie Ray from Forrester there.
Actually, we didn't. We had Suresh. I'm sorry,
okay.
I miss his last name, but he's another thought leader that they have there who I thought
absolutely.
Was very interesting. But
I think,
you know,
that
what you were talking about a second ago in terms of the individual, I think that's that first phase, and I agree it's tough to get that right, but I think it's even harder when you get to that next phase. So what I mean by the next phase is that if you explicitly set out a strategy which say that we want to use social media to launch products with, you identify that the best way to do that is to work hard to figure out who all the influencers are in the audience out there, And the moment you have those influences identified, you probably want to spend time listening to them and carefully understanding their points of view so that when you engage with them, you're going to have a conversation that's very directly relevant and interesting to them. That strategy that I've just outlined there requires some very careful planning and coordination so that when you do engage with that influencer, it's well planned and thought through and consistent and coming from just one part of the company. And what you're talking about, which is lots and lots of individuals interacting with the community, I don't know whether you do need to or don't need to control what the individuals are doing so that they don't accidentally mess up this launch campaign that you're trying to do where you're effectively trying to do something coordinated and planned. And that was sort of what I was trying to find out here is what tools can people think of that might help them and which startups, I think the startup area is very, very ripe for innovation right now. That's one of the reasons why I'm spending time in it. I'm looking for interesting companies that have got ideas on how this is all going to play out. But do you have any thoughts on how you would you try to somehow or another create some central thing which tracked everybody that was tweeting to make sure that you, when you were all going after this influencer, that you didn't accidentally have somebody, some random individual in the company doing something to the person that you're going to try to do a coordinated, planned approach to and ruining the campaign?
I think, you know, for me, the biggest objective is, you know, if you look at the Edelman case study of the Obama campaign, you know, the crawl, walk, run, fly, you know, you're really looking at something that moves towards advocacy. And Mozilla, for example, has done a really good job of it. It's a very good fit for their company. Salesforce.com has done a good job of that. There are a lot of B2B examples where they've done a lot of good work on the ground trying to build advocacy. And I think that the concern is to sort of outline, first of all, some visibility to your employees. When you're not a startup, this is for larger companies, I think, where, you know, they understand and become part of the process. So they feel included, and that feeling of inclusion hopefully encourages them to not use their personal Twitter stream to rant about how horrible work was that
yep.
day.
Yep.
And that sort of thing. The little things that can just add to the dialogue and be that can sideline positive messaging that influences a sentiment rating, which is still very early, but still can be very, you know, very influential, that they're not giving away any trade secrets and that somehow you're monitoring that in a way that makes sense. For most companies, I'm not counseling them to spend a lot of time monitoring that because it should come up in the monitoring that they're doing around their brand anyway.
Yep.
But the bigger question is if breaches are found, what do you do for enforcement? And that means you've got to get out of the siloed thinking more than likely, and you need to include a discussion with HR, and you need to include a discussion with other parts of the company. You know, if it's marketing that you're dealing with, you need to talk to PR and make sure that they know that there could be people talking about the company on a consistent basis and, you know, revealing who they are, and it's all transparent, and, you know, you haven't set anything in stone that says, you know, that this is or isn't hurting the company and ultimately their ability to stay employed, not just
yep.
because they could get fired for what they're doing, but because the company can't, you know, can't sustain the negative publicity of it all.
Right, right. Now, I think we're really in the very early days of this, and I think, you know, what you're talking about is exactly what I was trying to figure out here, which is what are the best practices for all these different situations that are going to occur. And if you're an executive, say the CEO of a company, you know, what do you do to get the best leverage out of social media? So you have the risk that it could spiral into a crisis. How do you manage that crisis? You have the interesting ability to find customers. If you're clever about using Twitter, you can watch for your competitors' keywords to come up and often grab companies that are out there investigating a competitor and actually get them to take a look at your own product if you do it in the right way. And the right way needs to be very carefully managed. So it's not a sales pitch, but is a helpful pitch. You can also intercept these unhappy customers that you'll find out there, and actually if you do the right thing and do it really fast, you can often turn those unhappy customers into advocates because you looked after them and turned them around quickly. And all of these different use cases, I think we're in the super early stages of companies understanding what they are, and I believe everybody's wanting somebody to tell them, you know, what they should be doing and what tools they should be using and how they should be structuring their organization to do that. And that's the gap that I see right now that I'm hoping to, you know, find good, interesting startups in. I think it's an area that you're also personally very involved in. But what's likely to be happening with players like yourself is you've got very knowledgeable third parties like yourself and the Altimeter Group that I think have got some great thought leadership that are doing consulting.
I was going to ask you about a research piece that they did. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I have a lot of respect for them. I think they're actually thought leaders in this space, but they're one of a tiny group that really seems to have good thoughts on this. But I still find that their thoughts don't go far enough, and they aren't quite at the level where if you are an executive in a company where you can just say, okay, I simply am going to follow this. Because this is not prescriptive enough yet for the average company. The average company doesn't have the level of imagination and the level of creativity in its employees to automatically do the right thing. And maybe there's no answer to this. I don't know. But it feels like it's an area where there's a lot of interesting development still to come.
And interestingly, I think a lot of it comes back to money. I was talking with someone earlier today at a traditional PR firm, and you know, PR firms are trying to figure out if digital is something they can monetize, yet, you know, I feel like saying, turn it over to me, I can monetize it, I can make it work for a company. But, you know, companies are still sort of, how much do I spend, you know, what's the return, what does the reporting look like, those kinds of things. So those are all realistic, tactical types of things that I deal in. But also I wanted to get back to the research that Altimeter had put together, Jeremiah and Ray, on social CRM. I'm on the board of Social Media Club, as you may know, and programming director for this area,
yep.
The Valley and San Francisco. And so we did a social CRM event, one of our educational events. And, you know, one of the Altimeter research was really talking to the predictive ability of CRM to tell you where customers are, what they might do, and basically help companies scale different pieces of their organization to meet the increasingly transparent need of the customer.
Yep.
I think that's a very interesting approach, and I just was wondering how much you've looked at social CRM and whether you really think it's emerging or if it needs to change course?
I think it's emerging. I think it's super, super early as well because, you know, I'll give you one example of a great tool I've seen. I'm afraid I'm not going to name the company here, but this is the tool where if you're a small B2C company, it will help you monitor your Twitter stream and monitor keywords in your Twitter in Twitter that you think are relevant to your particular product. And as soon as you find interesting people that look like they're potential customers or potential influencers around your product area, you engage in a dialogue with them, and at some point in time they become connected with you. And at the point that they do, instead of just simply putting them in your Twitter follower list, you start to actually track them in a database, and you track them with very specific keywords that tell you what their interests are. And then you aim to try to get permission from them to use some form of communications. And this is an interesting one because I think it could be dangerous, but if you get permission from that consumer to direct message them on Twitter, or it could be SMS or email potentially. And mm-hmm. this thing then helps you build up a database which you keep expanding and expanding and expanding by engaging more and more people in conversations on Twitter. And when you have something interesting to say to them, like you're going to do an event, and the trick here is not being sales-oriented when you're doing these kinds of events, but doing fun, engaging things. So you're going to run an engaging, I don't know, biking community meetup or something like that. then you use direct messaging from Twitter to talk to all of those followers that you've got. So that tool, what I liked about it is it's got a lot of very explicit workflow elements in it that are really helpful to the marketer. Whereas when I read the Altimeter papers, I definitely agree with everything that they're saying. I'm trying to go a level beyond where they're at, and I'm trying to dig into, okay, if you want to do that, what are the very specific workflows that you need to do on a day-to-day basis, and who's going to produce the tools that will automate those workflows? And I've looked at the list of companies that they, you know, that they talk about in their papers, and then when I look at those companies, I find, boy, these companies are really nothing more than monitoring tools, or they're still super early in delivering on the promise of this workflow. So another really cool workflow that I'll tell you about that one of my portfolio companies is a company called HubSpot. I don't know whether you've heard of those guys, but they invented
Brian Halligan has been on the program, and they've blogged about this show on their blog very kindly. I love them.
Excellent. I love them, too. I mean, there's a great example, by the way, of what we mean by a fabulous entrepreneur. Both of those two guys, Dharmesh and Brian, are great entrepreneurs, you know, just wonderful human beings and very smart.
Accessible and willing to share their experience as well, which I think is a wonderful, you know, wonderful thing.
Yes, they're absolutely great. Yeah, and they've done some really good things in terms of telling marketers exactly what to do with social media and really providing them with tools to do it as well. So one of the very cool new things that they're coming out with, I'm not sure yet whether they've shipped this or not, but it's something where as soon as somebody comes onto your website and is willing to give you their email address, they will use whatever mechanisms they can do to match your email address. And actually, Altimeter talks about this notion of matching as being one of the core functions that you need. So they're one of the few people that I've seen doing this matching well, where they'll leverage that one piece of data and then go and find out anything they can do from LinkedIn or Facebook or any other thing like Twitter to help the marketer do a better job of figuring out who is this person and are they somebody that's likely to respond to this kind of treatment and this class of product. So that additional information added to the profile is enormously valuable for a marketer in terms of qualifying and then figuring out what to do in the lead nurturing phase.
I think that's such a great – I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I was going to say those are the sort of things that I'm looking for a little bit beyond Altimeter. They're the detailed workflows. So they have this great vision, and what I'm failing to see yet is enough tools that actually deliver on the details of how you actually implement that vision in practice. And I think that's where we're really early, and it's still very exciting and probably should see some great startup activity.
I've got to ask you one question in the few seconds that we have remaining. Is there anyone that got away that you can name?
Interesting.
An investment opportunity that got away?
Yes, there are. I was trying to think of this is a tricky question. Trying to use my memory here to figure out the ones that will really be interesting to you, because there are lots of lesser known companies that got away. We don't have something like a Facebook, which the guys at Battery let away, which was a terrible shame because it went from Boston to the West Coast when it got away. My memory's so terrible. I'm just not thinking of. This is one of those things that I wish I'd been prepped for, because I could have hopefully come up with a great name for you. But I
come up with this stuff on the fly, so I promise I would have prepped you had I thought of it. Well, we only have a few seconds left, and you've given us incredible insight. And I'll definitely make sure Jeremiah and I sync back up. But I'd love to talk to you another time about all of your entrepreneurial experience, which we didn't really get to, because I just think the VC space is so interesting, and you're a great innovator in the space, and I think you nurture a lot of fabulous thought leadership on your own, which is very rare and special. So thank you so much for spending the time with us.
Well, thank you so much. It's really a pleasure talking to you.
As you as well. Have a great afternoon or evening for you on the East Coast.
Thanks so much, Jennifer.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I want to thank all of you that have tuned into the A-List with me, Jennifer Lindsay, and David Sok, who is of Matrix Partners and is a prolific blogger. Again, his blog address is forentrepreneurs.com. Be sure to tune in next week. Our featured guest is Scott Beal, the founder and CEO of Atlas Core. That's 1 week from today at noon Pacific. Again, thanks so much for listening, and have a great weekend.